there aren't nursing home beds available either. So you can see there's a huge crisis here of displaced seniors.
Older Alaskans struggle with the moratorium on applications to part of the state's Medicaid program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 22nd of July. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, polar bear experts call attention to a growing problem in the Arctic.
The indications already are that polar bears in some populations are highly contaminated and that this may lead to future problems.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the new AT&T, your world delivered.
The head of the state agency that oversees a troubled home health care waiver program says they're working hard to correct problems. Last month, the federal government red flagged the program and said for now, no new people can be enrolled. The home and community-based services waivers allow the elderly, ill, and disabled to be cared for in-home rather than in a nursing home. With approval, Medicaid money can be used for their in-home care. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
The federal government says more than 1,900 people were stuck on waiting lists for the state program. They say 27 people died waiting for assessments, and more than 200 more died while waiting to be reassessed. Rebecca Hilgendorf directs the state's Senior and Disability Services, which oversees the waiver program. She says it's important to note that it does not provide medical care. Instead, it evaluates applicants who want to be cared for at home. Nonetheless, she agrees that the program should better track deaths. It's now following federal recommendations and doing a mortality review.
Now, the people who apply for our services are folks with complications, different types of diagnoses and diseases, the elderly, the frail, and so on. And so it's not unexpected that over time, as the disease process progresses, that they pass away. However, the state of Alaska didn't have a system in place for reviewing that, and we recognize that that is a fault in our system, so we're working on developing that and implementing it.
The state is following up on other recommendations. Hilgendorf says the biggest problem is that a few years ago, the regulations were tightened so that only nurses can evaluate people who want to qualify for home care.
What we couldn't get past is the national or nationwide shortage of nurses, which is expected to go for another 10 years at least.
Hilgendorf says they have a 38% vacancy rate. So this week, they're working on emergency regulations that would allow hiring other people to do the assessments.
We know that we can recruit people with a bachelor's degree in social services and a couple of years of experience, that we can train them and supervise them and have them go out and conduct the assessments and get past this backlog.
The program hired three new assessors this week and bought computer software to help better schedule their time. They're also planning meetings across the state with providers and patients and plan to beat the federal September 1st deadline for a corrective action plan. As state officials work to fix problems, the federal agency that led the investigation into the program is talking with them regularly. Mary Kahn is a spokeswoman for the Federal Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, which is monitoring what's going on. Kahn says CMS had to put a hold on new enrollees in Alaska.
The reason that we stopped enrollment is that we believe people, at least temporarily, will be better served where they are until we can make sure that this waiver program is operating as effectively as it can and providing the highest possible quality of care. We don't think it would be to anyone's best advantage to be released from a nursing home where they are getting care into a community-based setting where they may well be neglected and their needs not be met.
Kahn points out they did not take the most severe step and entirely shut the program down. She says the Obama administration is in favor of home-based care and wants to see the program succeed, but she says the situation in Alaska is critical. Kahn says it's extremely rare that the feds would impose this kind of a moratorium and put a hold on new clients. In her dozen years working at CMS, she doesn't recall doing anything on this scale. Alaska Senator Mark Begich sent a letter this week to Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, asking that the hold on new clients be removed. Begich says the state program is flawed, but he doesn't think it helps to freeze applications.
Well, obviously, you know, the state has some work to be done. We'd hope the federal government would not stop at this point, and that we can get some time to work out the issues at the the feds have identified, and the state needs to get busy.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has not called for the moratorium to be lifted. Instead, she's looking to the underlying problem. The senator sent her own letter to Secretary Sebelius this week, reminding her of concerns Murkowski's raised in the past.
This moratorium has come about because we've got a 40% shortfall when it comes to available nurses who can certify or do these assessments. This is a real problem for us.
Both senators say they're staying apprised of what's going on with the program because they say it's of critical importance to Alaskans who want home care. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
Service providers and advocacy groups agree with Senator Begich that the moratorium should be lifted. At a regular meeting in Anchorage today of the Senior Citizens Advisory Commission, Commissioner and Administrator for the Marlowe Manor Assisted Living Center, Teresa Brisky, says people going through the assessment process are left hanging. Brisky says residents are in trouble.
We actually have two or three right now whom we may have to give notice to because they will not be able to pay. We don't know where they will go either. The families aren't necessarily, their homes are not designed to accommodate. They don't have the resources to privately pay people to care for them. They work, you know, they have lives going on. That's why they're living in our home. And so we're not sure where they will go. And my understanding is that the nursing home beds are, there aren't nursing home beds available either. So you can see there's a huge crisis here of displaced seniors.
Nursing home care is also exponentially more expensive than home care. The state estimates it costs $210,000 per year for nursing home care, as opposed to $20,000 to $60,000 for in-home care. There are four types of waivers in the program, ranging from older Alaskans to physical and developmental disabilities and children with complex medical conditions. Linda Meyer is the Senior Services Coordinator for the Municipality of Anchorage. She says the purpose of the waiver program, allowing choice about long-term personal care, is important.
I remember when we started the waiver program, and I remember how it really did open up the capacity for people to live in their homes, have services come to them, remain with their families, and what a wonderful program it was. And it really did open up services to Alaskans that had not had it before.
Meyer says the state has done a good job of balancing Medicaid dollars in the past so that people would not have to go into nursing homes. She says they're working to piece together different programs now to help those most in need. Doug Tolley is the Access Alaska Development Director. The organization annually helps 1,200 to 1,500 seniors and those with disabilities in Anchorage, Wasilla, Fairbanks, and Kenai. He says the program Ban Impact is growing daily, and they're looking for creative ways to help seniors.
We have some youth programs in Fairbanks, and we're looking at having some of those kids helping out in cases where people need some extra help. At the same time, we're advocating for an end to the moratorium and changes in the state system so that we don't end up with this again, and changes in federal law so that this wouldn't have happened.
The organizations agreed today to work together on pressing federal managers to lift the ban while continuing to work at changing the program. Next year's Democratic primary race for governor will be a crowded field, with three people already in the race and a fourth preparing to kick off his campaign soon. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Two Democratic candidates have taken major steps in their race for next year's campaign for their party's gubernatorial nomination. Former Commissioner of Administration and Anchorage Management Consultant Bob Poe, who announced his candidacy for the state's top political job in January, filed his papers with the Division of Elections. And Anchorage Senator Hollis French formally has announced his campaign for governor in Fairbanks and Anchorage. French is a former state prosecutor and now serves as a member of the bipartisan Senate majority and chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He says his gubernatorial priorities will be education, controlling crime, and making communities safe, while developing the state's energy resources. However, he's most widely known for his role in leading the legislature's investigation into Governor Palin's firing of Public Safety Commissioner Walt Monaghan. Palin supporters at the time were critical of French, calling him partisan. But French says he believes Alaskans respect the work he did and he's able to get beyond that issue.
My view is that, you know, the bipartisan work I've done in the Senate, you know, sort of transcends that claim that I'm a partisan individual. You know, we've worked with both sides now for 3 years in the Senate and have worked from the middle. We've done good work for the state. We've saved our surpluses. We've put money aside for a rainy day. And we've concentrated on the things that Alaskans care about: education, transportation, public safety, so forth.
Bob Poe has worked for four governors in jobs ranging from director of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, the Energy Authority, and as commissioner of the Department of Administration. Since beginning his campaign, he's traveled to communities around the state, and he says Alaskans are telling him the economy is the most important thing to them.
It's really about, where are we going as an economy? If this pipeline doesn't happen, what's next? Oil seems to be decreasing in the pipeline. Where are the other economic opportunities? I wish my kids who grew up here would come back and work, and I hope they have a job here. And so it's those kinds of issues that I think I, as a governor, would be very able to help.
The only other candidate to file paperwork for the office is Homer's Rob Rosenfeld, a director of the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council. Rosenfeld was in Canada and unavailable for comment. However, at least one more candidate will be added to the 2010 ballot. Ethan Berkowitz, the former leader of Democrats in the State House of Representatives.
I expect to be entering the governor's race fairly shortly and expect to run a campaign that's based on ideas and a description of the vision and the values I have for the state.
Berkowitz is already well known around the state for his run for Congress against Don Young last year. He says that'll help him with a base of voters he can build on. For the race for governor, he will continue the approach to Alaskans as he used in that race.
Fundamentally, the most important thing you can do as a state leader is to prepare the state for the future, prepare the state so we can take care of ourselves. And that's going to be the thrust of a campaign that I have.
The candidates have a long race ahead of them until the primaries on August 24th of next year. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an in-depth look at a common Alaskan experience.
Over time and over generations, they've adapted to that cold in ways that other people could only envy, really.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
Contaminants are an increasing threat to the world's polar bear populations. That's according to a group of experts who met this month in Denmark. A conservation organization is hoping the Environmental Protection Agency will help stop the flow of pesticides to the Arctic. The Center for Biological Diversity has announced its intent to sue over the issue. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Global warming is the biggest threat to the world's polar bear populations, but the levels of mercury, pesticides, and other pollutants in the bears are increasing at a rapid pace. Steve Amstrup is the leading polar bear expert in the U.S. and was just in Denmark to meet with other top scientists in the field from around the world. He says the contaminants issue stood out at the meeting.
The indications already are that polar bears in some populations are highly contaminated, and that this may lead to future problems for bears, especially if they're already compromised by reductions in available habitat.
The pollutants start out far from the Arctic in pesticides used for crops or in stain-resistant products. They find their way to the top of the world in air or water. And by the time the chemicals show up in a top predator, like the polar bear, they're at their most potent, more highly concentrated with each step up the food chain. Amstrup says, for most levels of contaminants, Alaska polar bears are better off than bears in other regions of the Arctic because of circulation patterns.
And those circulation patterns tend to bring the highest levels of various contaminants into the Svalbard region and northern Greenland and far northeastern Canada, and not so much into Alaska. So we're kind of just fortunate by luck of the draw in that regard.
But AMSRP is worried that luck could change as global warming affects circulation. The pollutants could make it harder for the bears to reproduce and cause other health problems.
Looking at the levels of some of these chemicals that have been found when polar bears have been captured for research purposes suggests that in some populations, levels of some contaminants are high enough to cause things like reproductive failure and endocrine disruption and immune system compromise in laboratory animals.
Scientists at the Denmark meeting called for more research on the issue. The Center for Biological Diversity is also concerned about the effect of pollutants on polar bears. The group is hoping a lawsuit will help convince the Environmental Protection Agency to ban some pesticides. The center announced its intent to sue the agency earlier this month. Rebecca Noblin is a staff attorney based in Anchorage. She says because the polar bear is a threatened species, the EPA is required to make sure its actions aren't harming the bears.
Under the Endangered Species Act, they have to consult on any action that may affect a listed species, and these pesticides are clearly affecting polar bears.
No one at the EPA will comment on the pending lawsuit, but the agency says it takes its responsibilities related to the Endangered Species Act seriously. The Center for Biological Diversity names 14 pesticides that should be banned to protect polar bears. But Noblin says even contaminants that were outlawed decades ago are still showing up in polar bear tissue samples. She says it's a problem that's easy for the public to dismiss because the harmful effects are in such a long delay, kind of like global warming.
Sometimes it's hard to sort of grasp how exhaust put out in LA can impact polar bears, but it turns out it's a small world, and through these global processes, toxins are making their way into the Arctic. Pesticides that have never been sprayed in the Arctic are showing up in the blood of animals up there. So it is kind of hard to grasp, but it's the reality.
And while Alaska polar bears aren't as contaminated as other populations, they're not as fortunate when it comes to sea ice loss. AMSRP says the ice is retreating faster above Alaska than in other parts of the Arctic.
In the long run, they're all likely to suffer from a decline in sea ice. If the sea ice continues to decline as it's projected to decline, polar bears are likely to suffer worldwide. But there's a great deal of inequality in how that's going to occur.
AMSRP says the animal he studied for 3 decades could be gone from Alaska, even within his lifetime. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
President Obama's pick to direct the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service got a warm reception today from key members of the Senate. Only a handful of Senate Environment and Public Works Committee members attended Samuel Hamilton's confirmation hearing this morning. Chairwoman Barbara Boxer said that's a sign he'll have a smooth confirmation process. If Hamilton is confirmed by the full Senate, he'll oversee the Endangered Species Act and how it's implemented. Today's only fireworks came from Republicans over concerns about the ESA, although they expressed confidence Hamilton would be, as they said, fair-minded. Wyoming Republican Senator John Barrasso criticized the ESA and said it's being overused.
The Endangered Species Act is not doing what it was intended to do. It's becoming now a tool of first resort for those who want to control Americans' every move. Often these supporters of the act celebrate adding new species to the list instead of celebrating when we've gotten a recovery of a species and gotten the species off the list.
Battles over the Endangered Species Act flared during President Bush's last year in office, especially over the polar bear in Alaska. Chairwoman Boxer emphasized in questioning Hamilton that she wants to see the Obama administration focus on science as it decides how to list species.
Isn't the most important thing that we use science and not politics to guide us?
That is correct.
Yeah, I mean, that's the key. And, you know, I'm not a scientist, and I don't know that any member here is a scientist, especially when it comes to this particular area. So I hope that you will rely on the science and not the politics, and not my calling you into my office or any other committee member doing so. And I think you've said that clearly, that science will be your guide. That's all that matters to me.
Hamilton agreed and said he's worked with state and local communities to find solutions to contentious ESA issues. He has 30 years' experience working for Fish and Wildlife and is currently the regional director of its southeast region. Much of his experience is in the Everglades and coastal Louisiana. Hamilton said one of the biggest challenges at the agency will be dealing with global warming.
Climate change is a transformational conservation challenge of our time, not only because of the direct effects, but also because of the influence that it has on the stressors that we have to deal with even today in our wildlife conservation.
Hamilton has been part of an oversight committee that's drafting a strategic plan on climate change.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Despite weeks of growth, the Rail Belt complex of wildfires have not burned any structures. The complex's three fires have charred more than 250,000 acres of the park's west of the park's highway and Nenana, and there are miles of active fire line. But State Information Officer Glenn Holt says the flames have not advanced in areas with cabins or other structures.
A couple days ago when the fire flared up, in the evening it looked like it was a lot closer. It has not gained that much toward the highway or toward structures. It's still about a half a mile to a mile away from the Teklanika River, and that's a backing fire, and we're hitting that with water, with water scooper airplane, and also helicopters with buckets.
243 people are working the Rail Belt complex fires. Fire crews are also working to keep the Chiquina fire in Wrangell-St. Elias National Park from populated regions north of the Chittenah River. Fire spokeswoman Kathleen Havelock says backburning and water drops are being used to try to steer the fire away from the area where people live.
The town of McCarthy is up here. There are several residents that live in isolated areas out along that, as well as small groups of houses.
Havelock says the fire has been following along the south side of the Chittenah River and McCarthy Road. At its closest points, the fire is about 4 to 5 miles from the road and 9 miles from the community of McCarthy. It's consumed 32,000 acres. A new book explores a topic Alaskans are all too familiar with, the cold. In the interest of research, Anchorage author Bill Strever takes a dip in the icy Arctic Ocean and even delves into the world of quantum physics. He also looks at glaciers, frostbite, seals, and igloos, among other things. The book is called simply Cold. In its pages, Strever delivers plenty of fascinating facts related to cold, including the unique hibernation technique of Alaskan ground squirrels.
Their blood temperature drops down just below freezing, slowly drops down, gets just below freezing, and they spontaneously start to shiver. In the middle of winter, they'll start to shiver and they'll wake up. And they'll wake up just enough, they'll not truly wake up, but they'll break this cooling period in their body, will start to warm up. And they'll go into a dream state. Their brain waves change into a dream state. And they'll dream for a while, and then they'll start to cool off again. And they do that all through the winter, back and forth. And that's how they get through the winter. So there's all this great stuff out there in the natural world. There's great stuff in the physical world. There's great stuff in the history of humans on the planet. And then there's landscapes. There's frozen soils. There's a permafrost tunnel in Fairbanks where you can walk down into the ground, that's been frozen for 40,000 years. And you can see tree roots coming down out of the ceiling, and you think, those are tree roots from up above. But you're 400 feet underground. They're not tree roots from up above. Those are frozen tree roots that look like they're alive, but in fact, they're 40,000-year-old. They're Pleistocene tree roots. So there's all these amazing stories associated with cold, and really it's kind of inspiring and exciting, and especially as someone who lives in a cold climate, you know, 6 months of the year or more, you're thinking about cold, you're confronted by it, you see it in the mountains everywhere you look around you. So it's just really a fantastic topic.
What is absolute zero, and why is it so hard to get there?
Well, absolute zero is the coldest possible temperature. It's hence the word absolute. It's zero on the Kelvin scale. So on a temperature scale that's different than Fahrenheit, it's absolute zero. It's about minus 460 in Fahrenheit temperature. And it's the point at which molecular motion stops. So molecules and atoms are always sort of vibrating. They're always moving. And that's really what heat is. Temperature is a measure, in a sense, of how quickly molecules are vibrating. At absolute zero, that vibration stops. And the reason it's so hard to get to that point is that in order to get there, you've got to put energy into the system. You've got to try to force those molecules to stop moving. And it is the arena of quantum physics. It's not the arena of everyday experience at those very cold temperatures. That was one of the things that people began to realize probably in the early 1900s, that when you got down close to absolute zero, you were not dealing with the universe as we normally experience it. Just like when you get closer and closer to the speed of light, it's a different world out there than what we would normally experience. Strange things begin to happen.
And what does happen to matter when it gets to that temperature? You gave some examples, but talk about that.
Even at much warmer temperatures than that, you start getting bizarre phenomena like feathers that glow, and that was a trick that was used back as early as the late 1800s, where people would give lectures and they would dip a feather into a jar of liquid oxygen, I think they were using. So quite cold, and they'd pull that feather out and it would glow and things would change color and neat stuff like that. But closer to absolute zero, in the so-called death of matter, the structure of atoms begins to change, and people talk about super atoms forming. And it's really very hard for me anyway to visualize what that means. And I think really the people that understand that probably understand it on a mathematical level, rather than on a sort of a visual level or a conceptualization level.
Were there other experiments that you followed for the book that were intriguing, such as this glowing feather that you mentioned? What other things did you discover in the research for this?
Oh, lots of interesting things about what people have done over the years. A great experiment in Fairbanks where someone watched a couple of students who were walking around barefoot on very cold days in Fairbanks, who apparently were part of some religion that asked them to walk around barefoot. And they had acclimated themselves to the cold very handily. So this scientist in Fairbanks took these students and took some military people and controlled into a controlled situation where they could cool them off and looked at their response, and ended the experiment very soon because the military guys just could not, they were shivering uncontrollably, and these two other guys, these two students, were having a conversation and were, to all appearances, just fine. Other things about human adaptations I thought were very interesting. In the Amma divers, the famous tradition of diving for shellfish and for pearls in Japan and Korea, the Amma divers have, or at least had in the past, really strong adaptations that let them stay out and function in water that would leave most people incapacitated after an hour or so. And they do it day after day after day, and they take themselves right to the edge of very dangerous hypothermia, and then they go back to warm-up sheds and they warm up. But over time and over generations, they've adapted to that cold in ways that that other people could only envy, really.
Bill Strever will talk about his book, Cold, and sign copies at Tidal Wave in Anchorage tomorrow at 6 p.m. Look for a review of the book in this weekend's New York Times. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.